Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. What do you wish that you'd known about your partner or your spouse before you moved in with them? One thing's for sure, today's relationships are definitely not those of our parents, and neither are the issues that we face today. We'll end today's show with attorney Gemma Allen, who, along with a bench judge and a financial expert, wrote The New Love Deal, What You Must Know Before Moving In, Marrying, or Moving On. And honestly, I never would have thought of some of the stuff in here. It's quite shocking what's going on today. So over the last couple of weeks, we've been celebrating 7 years on air by taking a few minutes to look back at some of our favorite clips for some of our favorite topics, guests, or books. And we're going to conclude that series today with a clip from a conversation I had with CEO David Howitt on the power of and his foray into the hero's journey. And we'll also hear from creative master and therapist Eric Maisel on productive obsession. He's written over 40 books, and more than 20 of those books have been on creativity. And I call him the master of creativity because almost everybody I've spoken to on creativity at some point references Eric Maisel. He's done some outstanding work. He's been doing it a long, 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 long time. And so we're going to bring that clip to you as well on productive obsession. But first, David Howitt was a successful attorney living the life. But at some point, he realized this isn't the life that I chose for myself. He described himself as a man who likes green smoothies in the morning and tequila at night. And so he set out to live a more integrated life. He became the founder and CEO of Merriweather Group. He's known as an inspiring thought leader with more than 20 years of experience providing financial information, strategic and brand counsel to early stage and Fortune 100 companies. And he wrote a book called Heed Your Call, Integrating Myth, Science, Spirituality and Business. And we talked about the importance of getting business taken care of while still living a purpose-driven life. Right before this clip starts, David and I discussed how we can live a more integrated life when we recognize the power of and now here is that clip.
When you embrace and, when you live from a place of, yeah, I set my alarm clock, I balance my checkbook, you know, I go into the office, I get it done every day, and I also, you know, tap into my intuition, which we all have, my empathy and ability to understand those around me, and my creative, sort of more artistic side, that's really where the magic happens.
Right, right. And you talk of, you follow the spirit of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. Again, I'm a huge fan of Joseph Campbell's work, and I know you are. But tell us a little bit about what his work has meant to you and how you've carried that forward into your work.
Yeah, so Vicki, I read, like, you know, maybe some of your listeners, one of Joseph Campbell's seminal works in college, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And at the time, I thought, wow, what a cool book. You know, there's something really interesting about this concept. But it wasn't until, you know, really the last 5 years that, you know, it started to really, I guess, kind of come back into my consciousness. And so I went back and reread the book. And as many of your listeners probably know, you know, Joseph Campbell was the foremost authority on mythology. And his thesis was that myths are something more than just great stories. They're more than just a collection of really neat, fun-to-read stories, but really what they are is they are the tough issues, the challenges we all face, the questions we all, you know, ponder, contextualized in story and in archetypes. And so his point was we can use mythology as a guide, as a roadmap, if you will, to help us navigate life. And in telling us this, he pointed to one myth in particular that has been central to all time, all geography, all spiritual practices, all religions. And, you know, if you stop and think about that, that's pretty powerful. That, you know, you could be an Inuit, Eskimo, or an Aboriginal Australian, and you would have this myth in your culture. And that myth, the hero's journey, is really formulaic. It always follows this very formulaic trajectory. And that trajectory and myth is really the basis of things like Star Wars, Avatar, The Wizard of Oz, most of the great movies, books, and stories. You know, there's an interesting YouTube video where George Lucas is sitting with Joseph Campbell and says, hey, you know, the reason Star Wars did what it did in the world wasn't because of the acting or animation. It was because I told the hero's journey, and it, you know, tapped into the collective in a major way.
Yeah.
So really, in writing Heed Your Call, and in the work I've done and my firm, the Merriweather Group, really focuses on, we took that hero's journey, that trajectory, and overlaid it against the life of the entrepreneur or the businessman, and looked at it and sort of applied our experience as having been entrepreneurs and also having guided, accelerated, and invested in other entrepreneurs, and had one of those moments where you're like, whoa, you know, this is really, really spot on and really informative. And so the book Heed Your Call illustrates in some ways each of our own unique hero's journey and what we can sort of expect and understand in terms of a roadmap as to how we go about that journey. And then it articulates 11 constructs that I've used and that I've seen used by others on their journeys to create abundance and meaning.
Right. And tell us how this has impacted your business, your life.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't want to sound overly dramatic, but it has affected my business and my life in really profound ways. I mean, firstly, you know, understanding and embracing this notion of the power of and, that I don't have to make a choice between being successful and having an authentic, purposeful life, that they can actually live together. They can coexist and really actually support one another. That has been material for me, and it's been something that we've used with our clients with really amazing success. And then on the hero's journey, you know, for me, it allows me to look at my life and where I am and say, you know, am I stuck in the known world? Am I now, you know, in the abyss? Am I on my path of transformation, or am I reaching my defining moment? And then understand which of the constructs that I've outlined in Heed Your Call might be available to me at any time. And then, you know, just following on from, again, your prior discussion with Dan, you know, I want the listener to really hear, I mean, I'm a business person. You know, I enjoy commerce. I've had great fortune starting, running, growing companies, working for large brands. And I also want to have a life with a lot of meaning and purpose. And so this is not sort of just woo-woo theory. This is stuff that, you know, we drive into our business practices every day with real-world sort of results.
Right, right. And you had maybe your first hero's journey when you spent 20 years of your life preparing to become an attorney. And
yeah.
And you get this job and you're an attorney. You're down in Portland, Oregon. And thinking what? I have to share this with listeners. Your life changed because of a tube of squeezed out preparation H.
You know, you're right. And so, you know, what I want to say here is I'm no different than any listener here today or anyone else. I mean, we are all born into our own individual, what I call known worlds, right? So, you know, for me, I was born into my known world, which was a culturally Jewish home in an upper middle class conservative Midwestern town. And in my life, you know, you were just sort of, it was known you would either become a lawyer or a doctor or an executive, and that's the path, right? And so I bought into that, I subscribed to that, and I went forward from my known world, accepting that as my path, as my purpose, as the Buddhists would say, my dharma. And I excelled. You know, I did well in school. I went on to college and did well. I took all the classes I was supposed to take, did the internships, built the resume, got into law school, did well, and ended up with, you know, what I thought would be my, you know, defining moment. I got a job at a prestigious law firm, the big oak desk, the assistant, the business card. And suddenly I realized, you know, I was miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, it was shocking. You know, I sort of like looked up and thought, wait a minute, you know, my life has been in service to someone else's ideals of what and who I should be. And suddenly I'm here. Everything I've done has gotten me here. And this feels really wrong. It feels wrong in my body. You know, I have anxiety, my stomach hurts. You know, I'm not sleeping well. It feels wrong in my throat, in my heart. And, you know, is this what life is? Am I just going to mail it in and do this? Do I have to suffer through this? Because, you know, is this what life is?
As many people feel.
As many, many people feel. And, you know, as a quick sidebar, you know, when doing the research for Heed Your Call, I interviewed a number of end-of-care life givers, primarily mm-hmm. through hospice. And the single biggest comment that hospice workers receive when people are reaching their final days is, you know, I live my life in service to someone else's ideas of who I should be. I didn't take a shot. I didn't live my passion, my dream. I mailed it in. I lived an inauthentic life, and I played it safe. And I think a lot of us find ourselves at that place in our lives. You know, maybe we're saying, you know, I've got the job. I've got the spouse or the family or the home or the cars, the things that everyone told me were going to make me happy. But why is it that I still feel disconnected, sad, lonely? Why do I have to reach for my iPhone, you know, every 5 minutes to distract myself from that feeling that wells up inside myself? And I think a lot of us spend an incredible amount of energy trying to quiet that voice inside of us that says there's something more, you know, that there's something different where you can be aligned with your heroic purpose, with your dharma. We're scared by that. And so for me, you know, I had reached a point in my path where it was just untenable not to listen to that voice anymore. And for those that I hope are able or willing to pick up Heed Your Call, they'll get to read the story that you allude to with the Preparation H tube. But really, you know, that was the start of my life in a way. You know, that's where I finally said, I'm going to surrender and let go. And yes, I may really disappoint my family. I may let down the college professors and law school professors who wrote me letters of recommendation. And I may disappoint my hometown community and all those things that ego was screaming at me. But it no longer was tenable. And so I let go. And when I let go, my life finally actually started to really become. And surprisingly, all those people I thought I was letting down simply said, good for you. That's awesome.
Funny how that happens, right? When we do let go and we follow what we know we're meant to do. Well, you can find out more about David Howitt at heedyourcall.com, heedyourcall.com. Or, as I said, he's the CEO of TheMerriweatherGroup.com, TheMerriweatherGroup.com, and his book, Heed Your Call, Integrating Myth, Science, Spirituality, and Business. Please stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Get a grip on life with Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we are going to conclude our series on taking a look back at some of our favorite topics, guests, books from the past year with Dr. Eric Maisel. Now, I've interviewed Eric several times. He's, as I said, a prolific author. He's written over 40 books. More than 20 of those focus specifically on creativity. And, you know, in my mind and in the mind of many who specialize in this field, he is one of the great masters on the science and practice of creativity. He teaches at the Paris Writers Workshop, RWA, the American Psychological Association, and many, many spiritual and scientific and creative retreats. So to set this clip up for you, Dr. Maisel shared that many years ago, a therapist claimed obsessions were viewed as negative. We didn't want to talk about them. We didn't want to deal with them. But he says that scientists and others know that there are also productive obsessions. And that's what this clip is about. Right before it begins, we were talking about how the brain wants to work. And the book was called The Productive Obsession. And here's Dr. Eric Maisel talking about how the brain wants to work.
We've kind of lost some of the language of the human potential movement from the 60s and 70s, but most of us realize that we have potential, that we have this brain that we don't utilize all that much or enough. We keep it busy. We certainly keep it occupied with all kinds of thoughts and errands and responsibilities and worries and what have you. We keep it busy, but we don't tend to really use it. And that's the idea of the book, that the brain would love to be used better if it were given the opportunity. What has to happen is that we have to quiet the brain more. We have to let go of the small thoughts that bother us so much and that occupy so much of our time, because at a neurological level, every thought is grabbing neurons. That's what a thought is. It's the grabbing of 10 million or 100 million neurons. And so if we're having lots of small thoughts, we don't have our brain available to us. We don't have our full neuronal capacity available to us, and we can't think our bigger thoughts. So one of the basic ideas in the book is, and this is, everybody knows this from both Eastern philosophy and Western cognitive psychology, it's really smart to let go of thoughts that don't serve us. And when you do that, you get your brain back, and then you can think about bigger and better things.
Yeah, this is quite fascinating, I think. I have a couple of friends. We've had discussions about this, and it seems that sometimes people want to claim creativity by saying, well, you know, my brain thinks a million things a minute. But you say if we're actually thinking that way, we're probably thinking nothing.
That's right. And that's right. Because for An idea to come to fruition, it needs elaboration, it needs attention. You need to pay it attention over time. And we like to flee from our thoughts. We find thinking pretty much anxiety-provoking. That's why so many people just arrive at simple opinions rather than thinking things through. This is true of all of us. We all do that. We arrive at simple opinions rather than wanting to think things through because thinking makes us anxious. So the person who says, I have a million great thoughts and I just let them go by and that's really my sort of creativity filtering right through me, probably has not had the experience that a productive creative person has of having a thought and then sitting with it for a long time. And by a long time, I mean a long time. Beethoven was notorious for hearing some musical thread, some musical theme, maybe a folk tune, and holding on to it for decades and decades and incubating it into a symphony 35 years later. So the brain has that capability of holding on to something and working on it somewhere in consciousness while we're doing our everyday things. And that's a talent and habit of mind that most people really don't cultivate.
Yeah, and you talk about this in the book. You say that any great event, any great symphony, any great story, any great play has gone, the creator has really gone through this productive obsession.
That's right, because, I mean, if you think about it, I think it's obvious that when you start thinking about your play or your symphony or your scientific theory or your home business or anything, it morphs. It changes as you think about it. That's what thinking does. It increases our understanding of a subject. Most people don't want to stay with that process. As soon as their idea shifts, they say they badmouth themselves, and they say things like, boy, I must not really know what I'm thinking about, or I must not have any talent, or I'm not ready to be thinking about this. And they don't understand that this shifting, this morphing, is exactly the thinking process. Anybody who has tried to tackle a novel or a symphony or a scientific idea or create a business or do anything that requires that kind of intellectual integrity knows that they have to ride that wave. They have to ride the changing tides as their ideas shift and as the big idea shifts.
Yeah, I find this whole concept fascinating. I've read a lot of books on creativity from creative people, and the one that always sticks in my mind is Twyla Tharp, the choreographer. And when she begins choreographing a new production, she doesn't change the basic structure of her life, but there's a lot of things she eliminates and a lot of things she puts into place. Is that something you would call productive obsession?
Sure. She must have, and no doubt she has, a way of holding the whole thing in consciousness, which is, again, one of the things that the brain can do. It can hold a huge amount of material, and then she's trying to figure out, not consciously, but somewhere in consciousness, she's trying to figure out what in this new iteration might make it better or fresher or what have you. And you can't get to that place of wanting something to be fresher or newer or better if you don't know the thing itself, if you're not able to hold the whole thing in consciousness. So I think that's a very interesting example of how a productive obsession works. You might be only making a small change. It may look to the audience like suddenly a dancer is doing, you know, four pirouettes rather than three, but that change occurs because you've been obsessing about the whole production and what the whole idea requires.
Yeah, interesting. You have actually, you worked with a group of people online, your productive obsession group. I wonder if we could share a couple of the stories from there, just to show how this works in place. I mean, where does one begin to, let's say somebody wants to write a book or wants to start a business, where does one begin to become productively obsessed?
Well, I think the first step, this is where I start with people in the group, the first step is what I mentioned previously, which is if you don't have your brain available, you can't really do this work. So the first step is letting go of thoughts that don't serve you. And cognitive therapists teach a pretty simple, smart, straightforward three-step process for doing that. And that's noticing what you're thinking and disputing those thoughts that don't serve you and then substituting more affirmative language. So I'm saying that quickly here, but I do that more slowly with people in the group to help them first, so to speak, clear their mind so that their neurons are available. That's a first step. The second step is trying to generate a list of what interests you or what you love. Most people are not that clear on where their passions are. They're so busy living and getting by and surviving that those things that they used to love, things that were clear loves at the age of 5 or 6 or 7, reading a book or, you know, being in nature, things that were clear loves then are muddier loves now. They've gotten submerged in the hectic lives that we live. So the second step is to generate a list of the things that interest you. And then to try to, and this is very mechanical sounding, and I don't mean it to be mechanic, but then rank order them. See which are the interests that are more interesting to you than the others at this split second. And then you need to commit to one of them, whether it's your home business or your novel or your new suite of paintings or whatever, or solving some personal problem. Whatever it is that you want to commit to, then you need to do that committing. And then you need to make space and time for the thinking. You need to get it on your calendar. Most people don't schedule thinking time. And if you want to productively obsess, you need time and solitude. You need a space with a door that closes and 45 minutes or half an hour or an hour of time to do this thinking. And when you have space and time and the object that you're thinking about, the idea that you're working on, that's the starting place. Then you have to stick with it. I ask people to stick with it for a month. I think that's a nice commitment to one's own process, to mm-hmm. stick with it for
right.
a month.
Right.
So that's the kind of the overview of the starting place.
I love in the book that you call it a magnificent obsession. I love that. I wanted to talk about two of the people that you share their stories in your book. There's a chapter 18, called The Turmoil and Calm of Process. And you talk about the Peggy and Ralph are the two people that I just wanted to touch on here. She said she was on the Productive Obsession Challenge with you. And she says, at the 2-week mark, I'm living my productive obsession and experiencing personality growth and change, but not in the way I expected. I thought it might be a linear process. Instead, I was overcome by a new energy, one that's softer and gentler and urges me forward daily. And people at work noticed she smiled more, she seemed calmer. You say, you can only attain this calmness if you accept the process of reality. What do you mean by that?
As I said before, people really like to avoid process. Many people will pay lip service to the word, you know, I love the process of creativity or what have you. But in fact, when you think about it, the process might mean spending 2 years on a novel that doesn't work. And when I say it that way, nobody wants that. Nobody wants the reality of process. Another way to say it is, pundits who claim to know believe that Beethoven's 1st, 3rd, 5th, 7th, and 9th symphonies are better than his 2nd, 4th, 6th, and 8th. And I have no idea if that's true, but what I know is you can't do 9 without 8, you can't do 8 without 7. You can't skip the things that don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what everybody wants to do. They want to skip the things that don't work. They don't want mistakes and messes. And this is perfectly sensible because in the rest of life, we're supposed to get things right. We've been supposed to be getting things right, you know, since the first grade. We're supposed to have been drawing inside the lines since the first grade. So to make this long story short, people have a hard time embracing process at a visceral level. Intellectually, they get what I'm saying, but at a visceral level, they don't really like the idea of mistakes and messes and investing time in something that might not work and all of that. But once they surrender to process, once they recognize that they have to accept the bad with the good, that if they write 30 novels, 14 may be stinkers and 16 may be excellent, you know, once they accept that reality, life really brightens up because then you're not so attached to outcomes and you can enjoy the process more.
Yeah, makes sense. Ralph was another one in your group, and he wanted to create a non-profit creative tourism business. When he finally accepted the Productive Obsession Challenge with you, he said the process was nothing like moving forward for him. It was like being in a blender and everything was whirring around all at once. You describe this as all hell breaking loose in your mind, but say a surprising existential calmness accompanies this chaos. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Sure, I think it's really interesting because two things are going on when we really bite into something. First of all, chaos happens because suddenly we're really wanting to think hard about X, whatever X is. Let me just flesh it out with some real example. Let's say you're in the sandwich generation, and it's a personal problem you're trying to solve, and it's where how to find the best retirement home for your father, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the way most people want to do it is get a recommendation or throw a dart at the phone book and get it done quickly and not really try to figure out what's the best place. But if you bite into the question, then suddenly you have 50 different things to think about, whether it's cost or distance from you or treatment methods or, you know, anything under the sun. All of that is the chaos of actually thinking. So you start out with this chaos, which is part of the process, but simultaneously you feel proud of yourself that you're doing this. That's the existential calm, because you know that you're making meaning. You know that you're accepting the responsibilities of personal meaning making and taking on the job of finding the best retirement home for your dad. So even while the chaos is going on, you're feeling good because you know that you're making yourself proud.
Now, how do we, when we're in this productive, obsessive cycle, how do we prevent when the negative thoughts come in, which, you know, I'm sure they do, how do we turn that around and channel it back into our productive obsession? How do we channel our thinking back?
I would go back to what I said before, and that is you want to notice what you just said to yourself. That's the biggest thing, because often we'll have a stray thought like, boy, this is a stupid book I'm writing. And it'll really be a stray thought, and we won't even quite notice we've said it. But suddenly, for some reason that we can't identify, we're not working on the book for the next month.
Mm.
So it's really important that we notice these stray thoughts, and sometimes they're feelings in the body, which are more complicated, and sometimes they're tricky thoughts, because we're very tricky creatures. Sometimes they're tricky thoughts like, I'm very tired, or I'm very busy. So those are other ways that we move ourselves away from the work we want to do. So to make, again, this long story short, we want to notice what we're doing. We want to notice what we're saying to ourselves. And if we notice a thought like, boy, this isn't a very interesting novel, we have to dispute that right then and there. And we have to say, sure, not interesting yet. That's why I'm working on it. And then you want to substitute more affirmative language. And it might be something as simple as, I'm staying put. Because the idea of staying put is very powerful. The idea of showing up and staying put is very powerful.
And that was Dr. Eric Maisel, who is, as I said, I think one of the great masters on creativity and living the creative life. And his book was called Productive Obsession. Productive Obsession. Actually, no, there's a different name for it. It's about brainstorming. But if you look up drericmaisel.com, you will find all you need to know about his work. And he's really, you know, spent many, many years, 30 years or more, just really studying this. I had a friend who said she finds him a little too intellectual, but I think if you really get into his work and understand where he's coming from, it's really fascinating. All right, we are going to take a very quick break, so please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we'll be right back.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. become a PAWS foster care volunteer. For more information, visit PAWS.org or 425-787-2500. PAWS.org or 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Jones & Company Pets, we cover the world of animals. This week, August 17th, it's a Dr. Nell's Sunday. He's an extraordinarily gifted healer practicing bioenergetic synchronization technique, or BEST. A treatment is like getting an energetic or electrical reboot for your body. Open phone lines for the entire show, so give us a call for a remote treatment for you or your animal friends. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Get your smile on with Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. So we began today's show, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, asking, what do you wish you'd known about your partner or spouse before you moved in with them? And that's what we're going to talk about right now. Definitely a rising number of couples are choosing not to wed and yet raising families together, buying property together, same-sex couples are entering into marriage, and now social media clauses are becoming part of our relationships. Yes, really. We're going to find out more about that in just a moment. My guest is family law attorney Gemma Allen. And she's going to give us the view from the bar, from her perspective. She's a prominent Chicago divorce attorney who litigates the dissolution of relationships that might have been saved had the parties earlier addressed the dollars and cents and sensibility issues. She's a contributor to legal journals on the subject of matrimonial law, a frequent television guest expert on relationship issues, and she's hosted think tank events on better beginnings, fewer endings for relationships. Gemma Allen, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
My pleasure. And this book is called The New Love Deal. You co-authored it with Judge Michelle Lawrence and Terry Savage. And Judge Michelle Lawrence, am I saying her name right? It's spelled.
You know, it's Lawrence. She said it rhymes with romance.
Okay.
So it's spelled like
a little. Yeah, spelled a little differently there. So Lawrence.
Right.
And she's giving her perspective from the bench on relationships and divorces and what we need to know. And Terry Savage is giving her view on the bottom line. She's a financial expert and nationally syndicated columnist and author on several many books. So what a little power team you have here, or big power team, I should say.
Thank you. And that's why I said thank you for having us on, because I always feel like any one of us is speaking for the collective group, because we became such a team while we were writing the book.
Yeah, I'm sure. And the book is called The New Love Deal, Everything You Must Know Before Marrying, Moving In, or Moving On. And so I guess let's start this, Gemma, if we can, by just looking at a couple of the biggest changes you've seen since you've been doing family law. I know it's changed drastically.
It's just changed drastically, and it's one of the things that's so much fun about the business I'm in, even though that sounds counterintuitive to say it's lively business. But it is interesting, because not every marriage is made in heaven. But what I see is happening now are more adults are marrying adults. And so you have situations where people come to a relationship with an already forming life. They have debt, they have assets, they have careers. I see more people choosing not to marry, and then you're into a different sphere, which is living together with contracts, without contracts, with children, without children. And of course, we see all of the same sex marriage issues. And then overriding all of that, we have really interesting topics about, are we going to have a child? Are we going to adopt a child? And what about artificial insemination? So it's a brave new world. People are meeting online. They're meeting without sometimes the depth of knowledge that a neighborhood would give you about people you're dating, because after all, your mother knew their mother.
Mm-hmm.
That's not happening anymore for the most part. And so it's a really different plunge that people are taking into relationships, and they're plunging into different pools.
Yeah, and I think this is an important book, because you talk about some legalities, but it's not all legalities, because relationships go much deeper than that. So describe the book to us in your own words, if you would.
Well, what we did with the book was try to, without in any way, shape, or form hurting the romance, whether you're going to live together, get married, same sex, opposite sex, but still bring transparency and financial vulnerability to the table. And what we find is that the sooner people talk about the financial realities, which we find may tear them apart later, but if they talk about them earlier, really get all their cards on the table, really are candid with each other, they're on a better team. Because I think now relationships really are us against the world, whatever the us is. And we need to be on the same team, have each other's back. But to do that, we have to really be transparent about who we are and not just enjoy all the, you know, endorphins. Let's talk about when the endorphins start to abate a little bit. What kind of a power team are we going to be? What kind of a loving team are we going to be? And how do we best do it?
Yeah, I was reading an article written by one of your co-authors, Terry Savage, and she said, you know, when people get married, everybody talks about what color the tablecloths are going to be at the wedding. And we spend all this time planning the wedding, but very little time planning the marriage. And she says that marriage is like a test. The less preparation you do, the more likely you are to fail. So let's assume that we're planning a marriage, not just a wedding, but a marriage. What are some of the first things we need to address with each other?
Well, I think some of the first things we need to address are where do we stand in terms of assets, liabilities, and credit? And we joke around about, you know, should you do it with a Coke, a glass of wine, or maybe a vodka? But one way or another, if you're really honest with each other, you'll sit down in front of a computer. You can't pull each other's credit reports, but you could each pull your own and talk about what you're finding on there. You each might be surprised about the positives or negatives on your own credit report, but let's move forward with that kind of transparency. And I think those are, you know, that's one of the steps that can really help when you're going forward. You have to talk about where you're going to live. You have to talk about, are you going to have children? And you really have to talk about it if it's a second marriage. How are we going to blend this family? And by the way, even if you're not marrying in the second round, you're going to be living together or sharing a meaningful life. How are we going to blend this family? Because you know what? Pretending you can just cut pictures out of a family picture and put new ones in doesn't make it true, and it arouses a lot of resentment. So if you want to succeed as a couple, and if you want to keep having these lovely moments together, you know, romantically and intimately, make some of those intimate moments about money and our future.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on the blended family situation. I know somebody who did not blend their families at all before they got married. They literally lived separate lives apart from the dating couple, and then suddenly they're expecting these teenagers all to live together in the same house.
Wow.
Without any, you can imagine, I don't even have to go into it, you can imagine what it was like.
I can. And Vicki, what happens is people are so in love, or they're so happy to have found the spouse that they thought they had found in round one and didn't, and then they're actually more grateful sometimes in the second marriage to find something that's going to work so well. And so they're so afraid of damaging it that they keep it under sort of a bushel. But the fact is, that is damaging in and of itself.
Yeah.
You've got to involve the kids. The best ones are where the kids are in the next wedding, where they don't feel disloyal because maybe their mom or dad, whoever, you know, is the other parent, is also invited. It takes a lot of heart, but if you reach out with those hearts, you're going to find out you're going to have more stability and longevity. And you know what? Forgiveness is free. And then if you're also honest about, now we have college kids from one marriage and infants from another, we have to honor all of those children and their rights to be raised in a financially stable way.
Right. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about nuptial agreements, whether they're pre, post, or co-nuptial agreements. You've got some great information in the book on that. And my guest here is Gemma Allen. She co-authored a book called The New Love Deal, Everything You Must Know Before Marrying, Moving In, or Moving On. And she co-authored the book with Judge Michelle Lawrence and Terry Savage. We'll be right back. If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Let's see if I...
I guess that... this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing. Writing it, another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Conversations Live is giving away books, from New York Times best-selling fiction to the latest from innovative thought leaders in business and psychology. To find out where, when, and how, like us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and look out for posts titled Book Giveaway.
Conscious Living for Conscious People. Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everybody. We are talking about the new love deal, everything you must know before marrying, moving in, or moving on. And this book was co-authored by quite a power team. Gemma Allen, my guest in on the phone right now, wrote her perspective as a prominent Chicago divorce attorney. Judge Michelle Lawrence wrote her perspective from a judge at the bench. And Terry Savage, her perspective from the bottom line. She's a nationally syndicated and a financial expert. All right, so Gemma, big question. You talk about nuptial agreements in the book, and this used to be something that was only for the powerful and the wealthy, and we've all seen even powerful men. You mentioned in the book Rupert Murdoch and Jack Welch, who both screwed up on their prenuptial agreements.
How smart they are, but.
Mm-hmm. Rupert Murdoch lost billions and billions of dollars on his. So why should the average person who's considering getting married talk about a prenuptial with their partner?
Well, partly because, as I mentioned earlier, people are marrying at an older age. They're 27 and 29 are the average ages for the woman and the male, respectively. And usually they already have some assets, some liabilities, some debt, and some future hopes and dreams. But one of the other ways to look at the prenup is a financial planning document and a financial transparency document. And if you look at it as kind of an opening rather than a closing, it's an opening to how we're going to live our life together. We're going to be honest with each other. We're going to plan together. You know, you can have a sunset clause that the agreement only lasts for a certain number of years. You can use it to just exclude certain assets, like your inheritance from Aunt Millie, that Aunt Millie doesn't want you to ever in any way, shape, or form let out of the family. Mm-hmm. You can use it to protect a company you've already established before you were married. But you can also use it to protect each other from debt. If somebody's coming in with overriding student loans or a bankruptcy from a previous, you know, failed business. And, you know, these are the realities of life nowadays. And use it as your financial planning document going forward and your financial truthfulness with each other manifesto.
Yeah.
So I think they're for everybody now.
Yeah. And you talk in the book about co-nuptial agreements if you're just living together. Same thing, because you just don't have the marriage certificate. You still have all of the same things that a married couple has to deal with.
Well, and you know, life just happens and you're living together and all of a sudden you have a trip to Europe, you have a condo, you have a lease or you have a purchase. You may decide that, you know, you're both wild skiers and you start to invest in, you know, a timeshare. Property starts to accumulate. Whose is it anyway? And with regard to a co-nup, you have to be really careful because title could rule in a CONUP, where in most states, title is not dispositive in a marriage. Mm-hmm. But in a CONUP, if you're just living together and, you know, you just keep putting it in one person's name because they've got a better credit rating or they're the bigger breadwinner, the other person is left out in the cold unless there has been a conscious effort to make a contract and an agreement. And you need to see your local lawyers on all of these documents because laws differ from state to state, but they can differ to your detriment or to the benefit of the other person. So be careful and think about what are we doing. One person can end up with a big trip for, you know, 20 grand on their credit card in their name, and the other person can end up with the asset in their name. And if you haven't thought it through and made an agreement, whoops.
Right.
And then if there's a child born, you really both want to take care of that child, and you want to think about how you're going to do it with both assets and income. So it's not divisive. It's romantic to take care of each other.
Yeah.
To take care of that child.
Yeah, I do. I think it's very necessary today. You know, one of the things I do want to make sure we talk about is the social media aspect of things. I mentioned briefly in the break that I witnessed a horrific breakup on social media with a couple of friends, and talk about embarrassing and talk about stuff you can never take back. Why people do that is beyond me, but it happened. And so what do we need to be concerned about and with social media? And do we need to put that in an agreement?
We are starting to see that more and more. We're getting a lot of requests for it, and I think it's a good idea because in the heat of passion, someone can be tempted to post something. I mean, think of all those awful revenge sites, right? They exist, and those are things that they endanger someone's career, their reputation, something that's so tangible and yet something you can't put back in the bottle once it's escaped. So I think the social media clauses where you would say there'll be a fine for every posting that we don't, you know, that's in any way embarrassing or mortifying or threatening to one of our careers, we'll put a fine in our agreement. That has a twofold purpose. One, God forbid you have to collect, but you could conceivably collect if a judge would enforce it. But more importantly, it says to both of you looking into each other's eyes, this matters. This is not light stuff. We're not 17 anymore.
Right,
we
right.
are now talking about our entire futures and things that, as far as we can all tell, Vicki, can never be erased.
Right,
they can
right.
be taken down, but not erased. And
yeah.
the impact, once it's sent from one person to another, is literally incalculable in terms of the damage to one or both of you.
Yeah. You know, I know another couple who one of them blogged prolifically about the traits of, you know, their ex, soon to be ex. And not only that, but about the spouse's attorney, and made some very vicious comments in her blog posts. And it came to the attorney's light, and she filed a restraining order against
exactly.
the blogger. So, yeah.
Right. And you never want, you know, if you have children too, you never want something so embarrassing about your
yeah,
children
yeah.
or your own relationship online. And let me tell you, as a divorce lawyer, 5 years later, people have huge regrets about what they said or did, even just in quiet pleadings or in quiet meetings. If that has already been, you know, literally posted and tweeted and is out there, the person who did it will be as regretful as the person who was injured, but the person who's injured will be very angry. So you're risking litigation and perpetuation of the bad feelings that you're trying to put behind you.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Very quickly, because we're almost at the end of our segment. We have about a minute here, Gemma. But, you know, even if we've got this nuptial in place, this nuptial agreement in place, you give the example of Jack Welch, who forgot to recalibrate it after 10 years. You know, things
right.
change.
Right.
When should we recalibrate an agreement?
You know what? I think marriage has, and relationships have sort of cycles. So as things are changing, you're making a big move to another state. You're deciding to go to Seattle because it's so beautiful. Your children are graduating from high school. You are now facing college funding. You're now beyond that, and you're thinking about how you want to give money to charity going forward. So I think relationships have natural time zones, and sort of answer your heart on the time zones and say, wait, things are really changing. We're selling the big house. We're deciding what university we want to do something for, or what college,
right,
or what
right.
sport, or what charity. So those are moments when you find yourself at a big decision point, do it together and think about doing it legally in a post-nup or in some kind of contractual arrangement where you're rearranging your love.
Great
but not,
advice.
Not changing it.
Great advice. Gemma Allen, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
You can find out more about this at thenewlovedeal.com, thenewlovedeal.com. The book again, The New Love Deal, Everything You Must Know Before Marrying, Moving In, or Moving On. I think if you are in that situation, you want to get a copy of this book. And you'll be ahead of the game then. You'll know what you might expect and how to prevent losses yourself. So thanks for being with us today. We're right at the end of our show. I have to rush off here, but you know where to reach me, conversationslive.net. You can email info@conversationslive.net or call me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. See you next week. Live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.